She took the most enveloping care of his health, his comfort, and his career. She was memorably faithful to him, not being naturally lustful herself, except for power. In consequence, he was so grateful that he let her rule all of his public and private acts. She could think much better than he could anyway. Her basic, effective policy was to recognize that her own strength lay in her sexual austerity and in her cultivated understanding of the astonishingly simple reproductive plumbing of the human male. Throughout their lives together, no matter how melodramatic the intrigue, not only could no one ever level at her the accusation of sexual immorality, but because Big John's occasional good health sometimes overflowed too impulsively, her enemies and his enemies had to give her credit on the angel's side for her loyalty and forbearance. Frigidity preserved her from temptation. Her ambition kept her insatiably excited. Johnny's panting and clutching at the passing parade of paid virgins she happily accepted, even though this avid forgiveness betrayed her own eternal inability to reach out in darkness toward fulfillment. 1 year after they had arranged for all of this bliss, the nation entered World War II, elating Raymond's mother because she saw the occasion as an acceleration of opportunity which would pull her John up the ladder of politics. She lost no time getting him set in cartouche against that martial background. Raymond's mother's brother, the Clot, had become a non-political federal commissioner of such exalted station that it often brought her to the point of retching nausea when she encountered its passing mention in a news story. She had despised this son of a bitch of a sibling ever since the far-off summer afternoon when her beloved, wonderful, magnetic, pleasing, exciting, generous, kind, loving, and gifted father had died, sitting upright in the wooden glider swing, with the history of Scandinavia in his lap. And this fool, they said, was her brother, had announced that he was head of the family. This foolish, insensitive, ignorant, beastly nothing of a boy, who had felt that he could in any way, in any shocking, fractional way, take the place of a magnificent man of men. Then he had beaten her with a hockey stick because he had objected to her nailing the paw of a beige cocker spaniel to the floor because the dog was stubborn and refused to understand the most elemental instructions to remain still when she had called out the command to do so. Could she have called out and made her wondrous father stay with her when he was dying? She had loved her father with a bond so secret, so deep, and so thrilling that it surpassed into eternity the drab feelings of the other people, all other people, particularly the feelings of her brother and her clot of a mother. She had had woman's breasts from the time she had been 10 years old, and she had felt a woman's yearnings as she had lain in the high, dark attic of her father's great house, only on rainy nights, only when the others slept. She would lie in the darkness and hear the rain, then hear her father's soft, soft step rising on the stairs after he had slipped the bolt into the lock of the attic door, and she would slip out of her long woolen nightdress and wait for the warmth of him and the wonder of him. Then he had died. Then he had died. Every compulsively brutal blow from that hockey stick in the hands of that young man who wanted so badly to be understood by his sister, but who could not begin to reach her understanding or her feeling, had beaten a deep distaste and contempt for all men since her father into her projective mind. And right then, when she was 14 years old, she entered her driving, never-to-be-acknowledged life competition with her only brother to show him which of them was the heir of that father, and which of them had the right to say that he should stand in that father's shoes and place and memory. She vowed and resolved, dedicated and consecrated, that she would beat him into humiliation at whatsoever he chose to undertake. And it was to the eternal shame of their country that he chose politics and government, and that she needed therefore to plunge in after him. Her clot of a brother had absorbed the native clottishness of her mother, a clot's clot. How could her father have loved this woman? How could such a shining and thrilling and valiant knight have lain down with this great cow? Everyone who knew them said that Raymond's mother was the image of her mother. After her beating with the hockey stick, she had given her family no rest until she had been sent away to a girls' boarding school of her own choice in the Middle West. It was chosen as her natural base of operations in politics because it was in the heart of the Scandinavian immigrant country. At the chosen time, the outstanding Norse nature of her father's name and his heroic origins could be turned into blocks of votes. At 16, because she had taught herself to believe that she knew exactly what she wanted, no matter what she got. She escaped from the school every weekend, dressed herself to look older, and arranged to place herself in locations where she could use herself as bait. She seduced 4 men between the ages of 30 and 46, got no pleasure from it, nor expected any, had definitely lost 2 of the contests after a gluttonous testing period, could have turned either of the remaining 2 in any direction she chose, decided on Raymond's father, because the man had a good open face for politics and hair that was already gray, although he was only 36 years old. She married him and bore him Raymond as soon as the gestation cycle allowed. Generalities, specifics, domestic manifestations, or her youth never made Raymond's mother's thinking fuzzy or got in the way of her plan. She knew, like a mousetrap knows the back of a mousie's neck, that she was far too immature to be accepted publicly as the bride of a man seeking public office. She knew that it was possible that her husband might even get slightly tarred because of her age, so she had set her own late 20s as the time when she would have Raymond's father make his move. Her reasoning was sound. By that time, when it was reported during a campaign that Raymond's father had taken a child bride of 16, some 12 faithful, productive years before, it would have become a romantic asset, and Raymond's father would be seen by women voters as a suggestively virile candidate. Meanwhile, she had accomplished her primary objection of escaping the authority of her mother, her brother, and the school. She had her share of her father's substantial estate. She had started a family unit that, with few modern exceptions, was essential to success in American politics. Raymond's mother was an exceptionally handsome woman who was dressed in France. This was quite shrewd, because money displaces one's own taste when one chooses to be dressed in France. She was coiffed in New York, and her very laundry seemed to have been washed in joy de Poitou. Her hair was straw blonde, in the Viking tradition, and it was kept that way no matter the inconvenience. Her sense of significant birth, her grinding virtue, and her carriage completed her preeminence in any group of women, and she assiduously recultivated all 3 attributes as a fleshy plant fancier might exalt and extend to orchid graftings. What was especially striking in the earlier photographs of Raymond's mother was the suggestion of a smile on her full lips as they counterfeited sensuality, and in her large ecstatic eyes, which were like those of a sexually ambitious girl. In later likenesses, such as the Time cover in 1959, and she being of the same political party as Time's persuasion, its editors therefore made an effort to supervise a most honest likeness. Where she was clad as a matron, the supple grace was gone, but the perfect features and the whole figure were stamped with the adaptable and inflexible energy that marked her maturity. One of Big John Iselin's favorite perorations in campaign oratory after the war, or rather after Johnny's interrupted service in the war, was the recollection of what he had seen and done in battle, and what he would never be able to forget. Up there at the top of the world, alone with God in a great cathedral of ice and snow, in the stark loneliness of Arctic night, where the enemy struck out of nowhere, and my boys fell, and I cried out piteously, O Lord, they are young, why must they die? As I raced forward over the ice, which was 30 miles deep, pumping my machine rifle, to even the score with those Nazi devils, who in the end came to have a superstitious fear of me. The point Johnny seemed to want to make in this section of this speech, his favorite speech, was never quite clear, but the story carried a powerful emotional impact to those whose lives had been touched by the tragedy of war. At night, while my spent, exhausted buddies slept, he would croon into the platform microphone, I would prop my eyes open with matchsticks and ride home. To you, to the wives and the sweethearts and the blessed mothers of our gallant dead, night after night as the casualties mounted, to try to do just a little more than my part to ease the heartbreak which Mr. Roosevelt's war had caused.